Welcome to the Once Upon a Leader in Africa podcast with George Nudu. We invite you to listen to influencers and opinion shapers narrating their experiences from their leadership roles in Africa, from the world of business, community development, government, corporate, social enterprise, among others. We will glean from their good, bad, and ugly side of their leadership journey and be inspired to overcome adversity, to pursue success against all odds, to be a great leader, and many other lessons. Welcome to the podcast, and here's George Nudu.
Hi, Rina, how are you?
Hi, George, I'm great, thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
No, it's really a great honor, Rina. Thank you for agreeing to be a guest on this podcast, Once Upon a Leader in Africa, because I believe you're a leader who's got a great story and many people in Africa need to hear it. So welcome.
Thank you, George. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit, who is Rina?
So I like to see myself as an exhorter. When I'm passionate about something, when I learn something, when, you know, a light bulb comes on for me, I want to tell everyone that I know, you guys, this is how things need to be done in this way. And guess what I learned? And I want people to learn along with me. So I'm an exhorter. I find that I'm also a teacher. But beyond that, I am the operations director at FIDA Investment Bank. I am a mom. I have three kids. I am married. And I just a woman who's passionate about God and helping people become financially literate.
You said you are operations manager of FIDA Investment Bank. Tell us a little bit about your leadership role in FIDA.
So my role in FIDA is quite interesting. In fact, initially I used to call myself KYM, Kandaya Moko, as they say in Kikuyu. I run a side of the business that has to do with operations. So, you know, your back office operations in terms of overseeing the finance elements of the business, overseeing customer service research. As an investment bank, what we do is we help our clients find good investment opportunities. So that's institutional clients and retail clients. We also help organizations raise capital. So if there's a company that's looking to expand, a company that's looking to grow into different markets or to introduce a new product and they need the capital to be able to finance that, we help them to raise the money, whether that's debt or if it's equity, as in selling shares to investors to be able to invest in that company so that then it enables them to do those things. We also do mergers and acquisitions. We also help companies understand their value, and we do valuations. We also do fairness opinions where a company perhaps is having a conversation with an investor or they're looking to someday consider selling their business. And so the question is, what is our value and what's a fair price? Is this price we're being offered fair? And so we go in and we carry out our analysis and our valuation and we tell them whether or not we think what they're being offered is fair. So those are some of the things that we do as a business.
And so your role as the operations manager is
to oversee the operations of all of that. And I work hand in hand with our managing director. Our structure is slightly different from most firms because I'm a director, but I'm also a shareholder. We do have a managing director. So it's like we co-lead the business. He leads the trading arm, which is now the execution. So trading on the stock exchange where we buy and sell securities for our investors and also on our own behalf. And he takes the leadership in that element and also helps me co-lead when it comes to HR matters.
Quite some leadership role. Any other leadership roles that you undertake right now apart from FIDA?
Yes. So currently I sit on the board of the Kenya Association of Investment Banks and Stockbrokers called CASIB. And I sit on the board of that. Basically, CASIB is the association of all brokers and investment banks in the industry. And our role is to lobby government, to lobby regulators in order to see certain things happen, to create an environment that is enabling for investors and also for us as business people to be able to provide our services adequately and to create an environment that is enabling for business. I also sit on a board called of a company called Norwich Union Properties. Norwich Union Properties is an investment company that is in the real estate sector. So I have served in that company for a long, long time. I think about 6 years in the finance committee, but now in the last how many months? I think it's been about 7 months I sit on their board of directors. Oh, there's one more. I forgot. I'm sorry. I serve on a very interesting board, an organization called Care for a Child's Heart. And Care for a Child's Heart is an organization that helps to source for funding to provide heart surgeries for children with heart disease. So these children are not, their parents are not able to afford the healthcare that the children need, and they need, you know, care. Some of them need medicine long-term, others need heart surgeries, and we provide the financing for that. So the organization raises funding, but also sources for doctors and medical assistants to provide free services to be able to enable these children to get the help that they need. I'm the chairperson of this particular board.
Oh, wow. Quite some board responsibilities that you have. And yeah, in terms of just leadership, mm-hmm, at that board level, you know, many of us at times don't really understand how board operate. So just from your experience being a board member, not even a board chair, so what kind of leadership do board members offer to organizations?
I think what happens with boards and organizations is that a lot of times the management of the organization is so busy running along, getting things done, and, you know, just trying to make sure that they, you know, get the numbers in, they're able to ensure that the organization is operating efficiently. So there are certain objectives, there are certain strategies that these organizations have. Now, the board is composed of people who are experts in their own right, who help to keep the management accountable to be able to achieve the strategy that the organization has set. Because the management and the leadership, you know, you're constantly facing so much in a day, in a month, in a quarter, that you can get so distracted by what's going on, and you need help with some of the things that perhaps you don't have clarity on, perhaps you don't have expertise in. And so the role of the board is to ensure that the management, the secretariat of the organization, are keeping to the strategies and the goals of the overall organization, and that the things that they need to happen are happening. So they keep the management accountable. So the role that they play is very, very critical, because sometimes you can have a management that has self-interest or interest that ensures that they get a bonus, or perhaps just get so caught up with the day-to-day that the larger goal and objectives of the organization don't end up getting met. So you have a board that has very specific expertise. So if I share, for example, with what can I say, like the role of the board, say, at NUP, Norwich Union Properties. So you have the management, they're dealing with customers, they're dealing with tenants, they're dealing with property management and that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, there's an expectation from shareholders to increase shareholder value, to increase and to diversify the investment options, so that then you don't end up creating such huge risk for the shareholders. Now, for the management, they can be like, okay, have they paid? Are the tenants paying? What are the debtors? So you get so caught up in that. When you have a board meeting, you remember, oh yeah, we're supposed to find alternative investment options. So board members must, just to sort of not just get to answer your question, they must understand the organization deeply. They must understand the strategy of the organization, and together with management, come up with a strategy for the organization, and then keep management accountable. So they need to be people who are innovative, people who are excited around the business that they are doing, people who are humble because you don't know everything, you know, people who also are accountable and will keep management accountable and accountable themselves, and have the interest of the organization at their heart and at the heart of what they do.
Well, well said, well explained. And it seems you've articulated quite well, and thank you for that. Because many people really don't understand boards, or even when you're invited to become a board member, you think it's just it's a title thing. You know, I'm a board member of this. There's that allowance for the board, bigger board member. You're taken to five-star hotel seat and all that, and they forget their role. Well, thank you for that. So if just to reflect back, Rina, which was your first leadership role in your life?
Wow, it has just flashed in my head. My first leadership role was when I was 27 years old, I think. Yes, I think I was 27. And I remember being called by a client. And without giving the full story, I was invited to put in my CV and ended up being appointed by the president, Mwai Kibaki, at that time, to sit on an advisory board that would later become the Youth Enterprise Development Fund. We needed to find a way to distribute ₦1 billion to entrepreneurial youth in Kenya. And he didn't know how would we get this done. So they chose six people to lead the process of figuring out how to disburse ₦1 billion to all corners of this country to entrepreneurial youth in a way that would ensure that the money then comes back so that then it's a revolving fund. So my first leadership position was a board member at the Youth Enterprise Development Fund. At that time, I was just a research analyst and not yet in a leadership role at my organization.
Wow. I mean, that was a national duty. How was your experience?
Wow, that experience was very interesting. It's the only word I can figure out to. It was heavy in terms of responsibility and very tough at the same time because we had to come, we came from nothing. Like it was literally 1st of June of 2005, and the president announces on Madaraka Day that he's going to give ₺1 billion. You know, a week or so later, I get a call to go to the youth fund, I mean, to the Ministry of Youth offices at Kencom. And we sat on a boardroom, six of us. I didn't know who the others were. We were introduced to each other and then given this mandate. And we had to then figure out where do we start? You know, it's like, how do we do this? And so we sat, it was late nights, trying to figure out what would be the best structure, who can we partner with to make this money go further. It was exciting as well and scary also. And I remember being appointed once we did get parastatal status, because now we had to move to a formal structure. We applied, got cabinet approval to become parastatal. It was then registered as a parastatal. And now we became a proper board with a secretariat. It was really a full organization. We hired staff and all of that. And I remember we hired the CEO at that time. And it also became the most difficult time of my life. Because as the chair of the Finance and Administration Committee, HR was under my purview. And the performance of this particular CEO was not in line with the expectations that we had. And I remember getting to the place where there were a few inconsistencies, a few issues. And I wrote to the minister at the time and asked that he be sent on compulsory leave. And that was the beginning of a horror story of my life. And basically, he retaliated by writing a whole 16-page document about how I tried to steal money and invest it in Safaricom IPO. This is now in 2008. How, you know, all these different things, you know, that I had tried to do. I ended up being interviewed by the Kenya Anti-Corruption Commission. That's what it was called those days. Interrogated about how I have tried to steal money. I was on the Mars report and all these different social websites, blogs about how Rina is trying to steal. It was a mess, a total mess. I used to cry every night. You know, I'm this 20-something-year-old with this heavy load on my back, trying to think, oh my gosh, I am literally serving my country the best way I know how, trying to ensure that resources are used in the best way. And in return, this is what I get. I'm being accused of stealing, like, excuse me. And it traumatized me. You can imagine, George, how excited I was, how thrilled I was to have the opportunity to serve my country. And instead, I was in a slaughterhouse, you know, somebody trying to destroy me. I remember speaking to a certain leader at the time, trying to get help. And I just realized that I have to then take a step back and understand how to get things done. You can't bulldoze, even when you're right. There has to be a way that you, I guess I needed the maturity to understand the politics of leadership. And that you don't have, there's ways you can get things done without being seen as the person who got things done. There are gatekeepers in certain places, and you need to ensure that you manage and maneuver those gatekeepers and understand who they are when you want to get things done. And I needed to have that maturity, which now I think I have. But it was a very, as I said, the word that I can describe my experience is interesting, because it was exciting. We did a lot. We were able to set up an organization from nothing. Today, the Youth Fund still exists. Of course, there's been many problems, but it exists. And there's companies and individuals who benefited significantly. And I can tell you who they are, who started by getting a loan from the Youth Fund. And it gives me such pride to know that I was part of the process of setting it up. But at the same time, it was very painful. Traumatizing. I remember one of the men that I totally admired was the PS of the Ministry of Youth Affairs, who mentored me. He was a PS at the time when I was appointed. He became my friend. And in the process of trying to do what we were doing, he was shot. AK-47, close range, because of the work that he was doing. And I was just like, oh my God, what country do I live in? Until today, then there's been no conclusive investigation on who murdered him. And so it was very scary at the same time. So yeah, I that's a summary of my first leadership engagement.
Welcome into the leadership world. My goodness. That is baptism by fire.
Oh, completely.
How has that experience shaped your leadership?
So first of all, it made me feel resistant to leadership positions initially. You know, the first reaction to all of that experience was, it's just not worth it. It's not worth it. You know, you work so hard, you sacrifice so much, and instead you don't get the kind of results you expect. People throw everything back in your face. Like that's the experience that I had. And so I had a very negative view of leadership, especially in certain positions. So it took me a while to accept leadership, including refusing to be MD, including sort of just shying away from opportunities that came my way, because I'm just like, I can't do this. It made me very fearful. But it also taught me that I have to have a strategy about getting things done. I can't just wake up, have a fantastic idea, and it will happen. And everyone will be happy that there's a fantastic idea that Rina has come up with. It doesn't work that way. And so I think the wisdom around appreciating people and finding and understanding the dynamics of an organization and seeing how can I get things done within the culture and the organization that I am in, given the dynamics that are here, understanding those dynamics first and then implementing whatever it is that I want to implement. It was a very humbling experience as well.
You know, when we started, you defined yourself as an exhorter, as a teacher. Mm-hmm. Do these qualities or these characteristics that describe yourself, do they play into your leadership style?
They do. They do completely. So if I can give the example of my office and my current role as operations director, I find that in the style of my leadership, it's about helping people understand, helping people know what products do we sell. You know, I get people together. Even if it doesn't come from the MD, I find I want to organize training sessions. I want to Let's meet every Monday and let's understand what's happening in the market. Okay, so we have this Ukraine and Russia war, and we have the Kenya shilling is depreciating quite fast. Inflation is going up. We have a situation that is very confusing. The stock market is crashing. We can't just sit and kind of just not know what we're advising clients. And I find myself wanting the people I'm working with being at a place of understanding, so that then they're able to serve their clients well. So let's meet, let's thrash this thing. How do we interpret what's going on? And I sit with our employees. I think also with our clients, all through my career, the reason I ended up where I am now, where I am, you know, like a crusader for financial wellness and well-being, is it started from me just sitting in customer service very early on in my career, about 17 years ago, when I was in customer service and sitting with a client and, you know, helping them understand why they're doing what they're doing, why they stock, not just what do you want to buy, and then filling in another form, sign here, pay here. You know, I just find I want to create a level of understanding so that then as I understand the client's situation, then I'm able to come up with something that works for them. So the exhorting element comes in helping people know that they need to understand and also have confidence as they make investment decisions. It's not just to sign up for a product. It's being able to understand what you're doing and how it aligns with your values and your goals. And so with everything, even in my parenting, if I see another parent struggle with their children, or, you know, when I learn something about teenagehood or, you know, sexuality, or, you know, I want other parents to know that there's solutions. And so that element of being an exhorter is consistent all through my life. I think what changes is my assignment in terms of, okay, now I'm at FIDA Investment Bank and this is what I do. Or I'm at Norwich Union Properties and this is what I'm doing. Or I'm at the Kenya Association of Stockbrokers, or I'm at the Youth Fund. And that's, so it's, yeah, I think those are just my assignments, but the thread that carries on through my engagements in the different spaces, I mean, is that element of who I am.
What you said is what I believe. You know, leadership flows from who we are and the things that we hold dear. And that's really a good definition of the kind of leadership you demonstrate. And talking about leadership and you being in the financial space, you know, investment, financial, and everything that you're engaged in, you've been engaged in all these years, and the organizations in those spaces, and there's a lot of money flowing, and a lot of things, good and bad, that can happen in that space. When it comes to, you know, talking about the kind of leadership that is needed in that industry, what would be some things that pop out for you? What kind of leaders are needed in that investment and financial sector?
I think we need, and desperately so, a leadership that understands the reality on the ground, that think beyond bottom line and numbers for their organizations. Because when you look at the reality of the industry, the continent, let me speak from a continent perspective. Africa has the lowest financial literacy levels in the world, the lowest. And here, financial literacy is not just a knowledge of terms like inflation and credit, and, you know, debit and, you know, those things. It's how do you interpret those terms for our personal circumstances, so I'm able to make effective decision-making. Now, what tends to happen is that you have an industry, and it's not just unique to East Africa, it's the whole continent, perhaps even the world, but I think there's a bit more emphasis in the rest of the world for education, even from the financial services industry themselves. But the point here is that we have an industry that uses terms that a lot of people don't understand, and they don't even take the time to help their clients understand. And so we need a kind of leadership that is sensitive to the realities on the ground, a leadership that desires to actually see families become financially secure, not just focus on their numbers and the bottom line. Because by focusing on individuals, by focusing on families and financial well-being of the population, then it will eventually impact your bottom line, because you increase the total number of people who understand what we're doing, who have confidence in being able to invest, who understand what options make sense for me, not just so that I can report better earnings, but so that we can actually become a better society. A leadership that is innovative, a leadership that is responsive to the need out there. The other day I just logged onto YouTube and I saw this app and I was like, oh my goodness, there are so many young people now who have decided, by the way, you guys, you can talk to yourselves, you people who are in financial services, us guys have found a solution that speaks to us. And it was an app that enables people to buy treasury bonds and other financial securities from the comfort of their app, you know, on the phone or the laptop or any device, without having to go to queue at the Central Bank of Kenya. And I'm like, you know what? That is a disruption that's happened, and it's going to disrupt all of us in the financial services sector, unless we listen and are responsive to what is the problem that our customers are facing, what is the need out there. And so, yeah, a leadership that is listening, a leadership that is awake and alive to the realities on the ground, and a leadership that values the customer and truly sees them as important and understands their needs, so they're able to come up with the solutions that are best for the customer, not for their own business.
As you're talking, was it Safaricom just removed their annual report, financial annual report, 2-3 weeks ago. It was just amazing to see the money that has passed through M-Pesa is even more than one of the biggest banks in Kenya. And that's telling, you know. So in terms of the technology, this fourth industrial revolution, how do you see it affecting just that financial and investment sector?
You know, one of the things that's interesting about this part of the world is that, you know, there's those, you know, the first revolution, the second revolution, the third, you know, for us, we are leapfrogging and just going straight into the fourth revolution. When you look at how many Kenyans have mobile phones, you know, even just the way that M-Pesa and money, mobile money has grown, it tells me that the phone and digital services are disrupting the way that things work. If you look at a company like Twiga, for example, Twiga Foods, they came into a sector that had operated the same way for a very, very long time. You know, where you have farmers, then you have the market, and then you have middlemen and the retailer at the end of the day. And middlemen were the ones that control this industry. Then comes this organization that develops an app to connect the farmer and the retailer, that then removes all this confusion and loss of produce between the farmer and the retailer, and within 3-4 years has completely disrupted that space. And I see the exact same thing happening in the financial services space. Fortunately, we have had a lot of the financial services companies adopt quickly. So for instance, you have banks with apps now. You have banks that are recognized anyway. These guys want to use M-Pesa, so they've connected with M-Pesa so that you can now transfer money from M-Pesa to the bank and vice versa. But most investment banks and stockbrokers now have an app that makes it possible for you to invest using an app. You know, a lot of these companies are now developing financial literacy programs digitally that enable people to learn from wherever it is that they are about how to invest. So fortunately, there's been a recognition of that fact. But I can tell you, if there's anybody in the industry who's thinking about coming or who's in the industry and has not adopted technology in the way that they offer and deliver services, they are under a huge threat.
Under a huge threat. Eh? And that's so true. That's so true. So moving forward, you know, as a leader in that space, what's your dream? What legacy do you want to leave behind as a leader in the investment and financial sector?
Not an easy question. I was at a summit the other day and I had a very serious leader say that, you know, you can think about Africa and wanting to make change in Africa, and that's really noble. But at the end of the day, if you don't have money, you're not going to do nothing. So unfortunately, my dream is noble. It's very noble. It's not for making money, but I really, truly desire to make an impact in helping companies and anybody and everybody in the financial services space understand the importance of helping people understand how to invest, what the products are, what those products can do for them, and invest in products that actually make sense for these individuals. I also want to create literacy programs, and I have begun that process. My legacy really is about distilling complex financial matters into bite-sized pieces that people can understand. And because I've done that, I have seen many, many more start to do that. So for me, I'm like, if we can be more people who help others understand this, create literacy programs in school so that children understand how to manage their money and how to be responsible in how they manage their money. Create programs so that those who are thinking about retiring know what to do and how can I retire? How can I plan for my retirement as a 25-year-old, as a 30-year-old? How can I think about those things now so that then I'm not shocked when it's 65 and when I'm 65 and it's time to retire and I don't know where to start? And so what does that look like? It's continuing to write programs, continue to write books, continue to speak and produce content. I currently have over 400 videos up on YouTube, and I continue to train through an online program that I began called Investable. We began the program last year. We already have an alumni of 312 people who have gone through the program, and I see that growing even further. And the reason it's an online program is so that it can scale. So then it's not just limited to my ability to meet people, because that's not scalable. So it's to create scalable solutions so that people can become financially literate. I desire to see a continent of financially secure families. That's my ultimate dream. I have said it in many words, but that's my ultimate dream.
Rina, well said. So my question is, and I think you had alluded to me some time ago, but where did you learn really about finances? Where were your first financial literacy classes?
So when we were younger and I was in school, we used to have a tuck shop. I guess those days we sometimes carried lunch, but we also could have money and break time. I remember specifically it was break time, because lunch was provided by the school or you carried lunch, but we used to have a tuck shop, and sometimes we'd go for school trips, and my father would ask, how much do you need? And then I'd give a number, and sometimes he'd give me less or he'd give the exact amount of money and wants an account for how we've spent the money. And so it was very frustrating for me. I know other children possibly learned, oh, that's how you budget. It wasn't as romantic as that for me. It was just, I have a very mean father. You know, I mean, what is this? I have to account for everything. I ask for 200, he gives me 150. Like, what is the problem? Now, fast forward, I remember I wanted to go to university abroad. My parents had us really young. By 23, my mom had all of us. And so you can imagine, you know, they were fairly young by the time I was ready to go to university. I was ready to go to university at 19. And they were not wealthy. And so it was, okay, we're going to just find a way to make this work. We can find money for your tuition, but upkeep, Gina, you're going to have to sort it out yourself. So they said they were going to save as much as possible. I suspect they borrowed, I'm not too sure, but they gave me 600,000 shillings worth of Australian dollars for the first 6 months of my life in Australia to just sort of set me up as I look for work, as I figure out how to make this happen. Then I'd comfortably be able to transition into self-sustaining mode after that. And that was the biggest lesson for me, because I guess I had taken all these different things my father had tried to teach me as I was growing up. And I can tell you, by month four, I had spent all my money. I hated to cook. I was very different from my siblings. My siblings used to cook and whatever. For me, I'd cook at home and I'd feel like someone is giving me the biggest punishment ever. So when I went to Australia with all these different fast food places, I spent all my money by month four. And I remember feeling, oh my gosh, I have $3 in my account, not even enough to withdraw from the ATM. What am I going to do? And for 2 weeks, George, I moved from one apartment to the other. So I lived in student housing. And so I'd go to my friend's units and ask, okay, so what's for homework? Which was such a lie, because I'm one of those goody two-shoes students. And so I'd be like asking what's for homework to stay long enough to have dinner, because they'll have cooked, because I didn't have even, yani I couldn't buy even spinach for cooking. You understand? I had no money. So I do not have eaten breakfast, didn't eat lunch. Then at now dinner time, I'm looking, now who's the person am I going to today so I can get a meal? After 2 weeks, I had gone around and I couldn't go around. It was even embarrassing. I remember this one day, I hadn't eaten. I was really hungry. So I decided, let me just go to bed. I woke up because I couldn't sleep. And I walked to the kitchen and I'm like, what am I going to do? Let me just check my cupboard. Maybe somebody somewhere has left something for me. And I remember opening it and seeing this tin of coffee, poured myself a coffee to kind of just, I mean, because I couldn't sleep. And as I was sipping my coffee, my eyes rolled to the bin and I saw this over-toasted slice of bread, completely burnt, that somebody had thrown. And so I picked it up, I scraped it off, and I ate it. And I was like, wow, at least I found a meal, but wow, this is where it has come to. And that was my wake-up moment. Because I realized I had the opportunity to plan myself well. I had the opportunity to think through and get a job and think through how am I going to make this money stretch, but I had been irresponsible. And I realized that, you know, I can't live life like this. And I remember that night promising myself that I will never, ever, ever, ever in my life be in this situation again. It wasn't even about being wealthy. It was about making sure that at any point in my life, I'm able to afford my lifestyle and do the things that I need to do and not get into a desperate situation. And so I made a promise to myself. And that's where my journey really, truly began. And I became hungry to understand, how do I manage the money I have? How can I be better in planning? And how can I work? And where do I save? And things like that. I mean, it took many years for me to grow, and I'm still growing. But I think that that was the beginning of my journey. I can imagine if I had the kind of parents who said to me, no, don't worry, you just go to school and don't worry about money, I would never have learned the things that I learned. And so it's that lack, that brokenness, that desperation that got me to the place where I needed to really, truly understand how to manage my money.
Where's the place of financial literacy in the home?
So I don't even know whether, I don't ever remember, George, my father telling me, this is how you manage money, to be honest. It was how he operated. It was what he did. I remember he would always say, we have to go with a list. If it's not on the list, we're not buying when we're going shopping. Like now, for example, we had to plan our movements. Okay, so where are you going today? Can you, and you know, it's like, you can't just, I remember when we learned how to drive, I learned how to drive fairly young. And I mean, by 17, we're within the neighborhood, I could drive. And so it's like, I need to go get this and I need to go get the other. But he'd always be like, no, you're wasting fuel. Can you decide what you need to do and then make one trip instead of this back and forth and back and forth? So it's in those moments, I think he found teachable moments, and my mom as well, they found teachable moments in our day-to-day lives to train us on how to manage finances. So I think children will always forget what you tell them, but they will always remember what they see and experience. And so what teachable moments can we as parents take advantage of when it comes to teaching our parents, our children, about managing money, and find a way to help them then learn those lessons, because those are the most powerful.
Wow, thank you. Indeed. So true, that really powerful moments. And really, thank you so much for your story. Really, really nice story. So even to ask, and I usually like asking my guests this last question, from just your leadership story and your experience in the financial space, and thank you for even sharing personal things about the way you've learned about money. What's the moral of your story?
You know, when I think back about my life and all the different things that have happened to me and the experiences that I have had, I feel like I have taken them as learning opportunities, and I've had to get to because I've had really dark moments, to be honest, in the journey, but I've had to find the opportunity in that dark moment, and it's consistent throughout my life. So I remember, I'll just share one last story. It was 2007, and in fact, it started in 2006. In 2006, Chase Bank collapsed, and we were banking with Chase Bank as an organization. We had other bank accounts, but Chase Bank had, you know, a huge amount of our client funds, and the bank closed before we were able to withdraw everything, and that was tough. We had also advised on a certain transaction for a company that existed, and anyway, I can say who it is. It's public information. And that company used the funds we raised for them, not in the way that they had said they would. And it ended up going under. And that was what drew me. And the government was like, who is responsible for this? And so they said, you guys raised money for these guys, and then they've gone under. You are not honest about how they are performing, and therefore you are suspended for the next 6 months on being able to advise on these sorts of transactions. And I'm like, I'm sorry, what? We raised money for them with the information they provided us, used the money for something else, and now we're getting punished for that. Anyway, long story short, George, my department was shut down for 6 months. And you can imagine what that does for an organization in a sensitive industry such as ours. Getting business was very tough, even after the 6 months were up. So for 2 years, we literally did no corporate finance advisory work at all. And I remember in that season was when my book was born, Moneywise, Create, Grow, and Preserve Wealth. In that season was when I began doing YouTube videos. In that season was when I became a coach, or at least decided I'm going to sign up for coaching. And in that season of wilderness was when I said, I'm not going to wallow. And I can't even remember whether it was a conscious decision. I just deflected by throwing myself into something I was passionate about at that time and saying, I'm useful for something. Let me do what I know to do. While this thing sorts itself out, let me just throw myself into this thing and invested in what I now also do, which is running this company called RH Group, which does training and coaching and content creation. So what am I saying? It's not a straight line. Life is not a straight line. There's curves, there's valleys, there's dark moments. But in those dark moments, we need to be very careful not to be lost in those dark moments. Napoleon Hill says, in every failure, in every adversity, in every heartache, there's always an equal or greater benefit. You know, you can listen to those words and be like, I'm sorry, what? In every heartache, there's an equal or greater benefit out of that heartache. But it is true, and I've seen it in my own life. In the heartache of being in the youth fund and being accused of something I didn't do, in the heartache of being accused again and losing business for 2 years, in the heartache of the confusion of all of that, there was an equal or greater benefit in me discovering my passion, in me being able to throw myself into something else and making something of that to be able to discover who I am. You asked me a question, who are you? I didn't answer, I am an investment banker, because I know who I am. And it was in that dark moment that I was able to discover, hey, yeah, this is actually who I am. And nobody and nothing can say anything, George, that will make me phased about who I am, because I know who I am. So I think that's the conclusion of what I would say for anybody, irrespective of where you are. In every heartache, in every failure, in every difficult situation that you go through, there is an equal or greater benefit. So try and find it, and then you will find it.
Wow. And I agree with you. That is a powerful way of ending our session today. And really, your leadership story demonstrates that. Thank you so much, Rina, for sharing your leadership, your life, and your experiences with us. I wish you success, even as you continue selling your book, teaching people about financial literacy and everything else that you are doing. Thank you and God bless you.
Thank you for joining us in today's podcast. We hope you're leaving with insights that will help you live and lead better. We appreciate our sponsors, BNG Consultants Limited and BNG Center for Leadership Coaching, for keeping us on air. Bye for now. See you in our next episode.